We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 67. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Monica Smith about the birth and evolution of cities.
Let's dig a little deeper. Our guest today is Monica Smith, a professor of anthropology and professor in the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at the University of California, Los Angeles. She holds the Navin and Pratima Doshi Chair in Indian Studies and serves as the director of the South Asian Archaeology Laboratory in the Khotsen Institute of Archaeology. Her archaeological experience includes fieldwork in Egypt, England, India, Italy, Tunisia, Bangladesh, Turkey, and Madagascar, supported by highly competitive research grants from the National Science Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the National Geographic Society. Today, specifically, we are talking about her new book, Cities, The First 6,000 Years, published in 2019 by Viking, an imprint of Penguin Random House, LLC. So check that out. We will have a link to it in the show notes. All right, Monica, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so the primary focus of this episode, as we mentioned in the introduction, is talking about your new book, Cities, The First 6,000 Years. And I got to tell you, I was sent a copy. I think I got it on Monday. We're recording on a Thursday, so I haven't quite finished the whole thing, but I've read about half of it and looked through the rest of it in advance of this interview. And it's fascinating. I love learning and thinking about cities. For the first time in my life, I actually lived in a downtown city for 2 years, and I just ended that about 5 months ago. Now, it was Reno, Nevada, so it's kind of a starter city, I called it. It's a real city in the sense that, I guess there's big buildings and stuff and all the other things that, like you mentioned, is defining a city, which I also thought was fascinating. But that made me really interested in cities and how cities work and things like that. So what first got you interested in studying cities? Because, I mean, most archaeologists are like, let's study this one thing in a city or in a thing. But you're like, nope, I'm going go big or go home. You know,
that's right. Well, you know, cities are all around us. And archaeologists, just like any other scientists, study things that they are inherently interested in and that they love. And so, you know, you've had other guests on your show who are dealing with small scale societies or stone tool production. And in every case, the things that we study are things that we have found really fascinating for ourselves and that we want to get more in depth with. In my particular case, I'm from Southern California. I've always lived in an urban environment. I've traveled to a variety of cities growing up, which I really appreciated. But I didn't really realize that I was an urban person until I had gone to graduate school in the Midwest in a small college town. And after that, I moved straight to Manhattan. And it was this sense of, like, you know, crossing the bridge, coming into Manhattan, and I just felt this sense of being at home, even though I had never lived in Manhattan. And that was when the penny first dropped about what it was about urbanism, that once you've lived in one place, you can read another city pretty well. You can function in another city pretty well. And so my archaeological research just went along from there.
Nice. I'm curious. I mean, you've worked in many places around the world, and you've visited many places around the world, seen cities, seen ancient cities, you know, cities that are thousands of years old. I mean, I've been to Rome, and Rome is thousands of years old. And it's just, you know, it's amazing seeing the mix of old and new. And I'm also thinking about Notre Dame and how, you know, when that burned down, and now what that looks like with the skyline of Paris and how that's going to change, and just thinking about cities and how they evolve from that standpoint. How do you go about studying cities and the evolution of cities when we typically excavate on such a small scale? What do you study in order to bring this all together?
Right. You know, when archaeologists excavate, usually the biggest excavation that we can do is about the size of an Olympic swimming pool. And if you think about dropping that size of investigation into any city, whether ancient or modern, you're right that it's a very, very small slice of things. But there are ways that we can cumulatively address ancient cities that put together multiple research projects. So archaeologists always work in teams. And when we think about working at cities, what we're thinking about is stringing together not only our own teams, but all the teams that have come before us. And a really good example of that is the City of London. Of course, there is not much space to excavate in London, but people are looking underground all the time. They are digging parking lots. They are digging new infrastructure footings. They are digging new basements for buildings. And every time they do that, they put what they find into this giant database that's run by the Museum of London Archaeology. And you can actually go online now and you can query all the places where there are Roman remains or all the places where there are medieval remains. And so bit by bit, we're building these maps of the underground of the archaeology of those cities.
Okay. That's fascinating. I mean, maps, without maps, where would we be, right?
Exactly, exactly. You know, mapping is that spatial component. And the reason that I think a lot of the really interesting theory in social science is actually coming out of geography these days, because they have this physical spatial component to human activities and human behavior. And a lot of the things that anthropologists do, like ethnography and interviewing people, are also things that geographers are doing now.
This is Chris. April had some issues early on in the show here, but we fixed them later. But she's got a question and for Monica, and what she wants to know is, how are we defining cities? Because when we look at cities like London and other cities, they've been around for a really long time. When did they become cities? How do they define cities? And you know, what does that look like?
That's a great question, because, of course, before about 6,000 years ago, everybody on the planet lived in a small village, and those small villages were maybe 50 to 100 people or so, and you knew everybody else, and you had known them from the beginning of your life to the end. And cities are radically different from that. But defining what makes the first city or that makes a functioning urban settlement is really based in a lot of the same criteria that we use for modern urbanism. Like on our landscape today, we know that there are hamlets and towns and villages, and then there are things that we call cities. So for both modern and ancient cities, we think of things like population density, how many people are in a space, how many people are there in total? What is the variety of services, employment, education, architecture that you find in an urban place? What are the economic opportunities that you find? So that an ancient city would have been, you know, pretty small by our standards, but still had all of those things that encompassed administrative, social, ritual, economic functions, and that also had strangers. So that you had people who were coming in who could make a life for themselves in the city, but who may not have known anybody else around them. And that threshold is somewhere around, say, you know, 5 to 10,000 people. So even today, you know, we might think that 5,000 people is much too small to be a city, but interestingly, our official definitions of cities are often actually that small. So in Ohio, for example, to be a city, you have to have 5,000 people. And that's a legal threshold that then, you know, when your settlement is a city, you have access to all of these other kinds of federal state money. So everybody is trying to be a city, even if their population sizes are pretty small. So we might think of modern and ancient as being very different, but actually the criteria for defining a city are really about the same.
That's interesting to me because, you know, like you said, our modern criteria for a city, I mean, I like the analogy you use in your book as well. You mentioned the pornography analogy. You might not be able to define it, but you know it when you see it. I always like that one. But this is the same thing with a city. Like you might look at a place and say, ah, is this a city or not? But when you see a city that you know is a city, I mean, it's a real city. But then I find it interesting that a lot of the definitions of us applied to a city outside of population, like you mentioned, certain services, people coming in, trade happening, you know, merchants, things like that. I mean, those also define a lot of smaller and larger towns that I wouldn't necessarily consider a city. Like I think Nevada has essentially two cities, Reno and Las Vegas, and maybe some of the ones around Las Vegas, like Henderson and North Las Vegas and things like that, that are like outliers. But the rest of the towns in Nevada are really just towns, but they have a lot of the attributes of a city. So it becomes really difficult to define. Along those lines, what was the first city? And how do we define that?
Well, archaeologists are just like any other kind of scientist or just like any other kind of person. They like to have the biggest, the oldest, the most complex of any particular kind of phenomenon. And yet there are a couple of good candidates for the earliest cities. And in the book, I talk about the site of Tel Brak, which is now in Syria and is part of this large mm-hmm. Mesopotamian network of cities that also included many cities in southern Mesopotamia. And so cities did not seem to be born out of a single impulse, but more like a kind of network of interconnections that meant that once people were occupying a densely settled place and engaging in infrastructure and architecture and economic and educational activities, that people elsewhere were also engaging in those same kinds of complexities. Because if you're thinking about trade, well, trade from one city is going to another place. And that other place then also starts to pick up all of these other attributes of population and administration. So most of the ancient cities that we have are in networks of population. And trying to slice very thinly which one was actually first, when the time separation might be something like 10 or 20 or 50 years, very hard to tell in archaeological terms. So we, I think, could have legitimately a variety of cities call themselves the first in the world. And then, of course, every continent, with the exception of Australia, also had its first cities. So in South America, it's places like Caral in Mesoamerica, Mexico, you also have early contenders. Mm-hmm. So every place has its own first city, but very quickly afterwards, they also have their second and third and fourth cities.
Who do researchers in your circle think may have started the first cities or how they started? I know, but I was just kind of thinking about this when reading your book and some of the other literature is, to me, it could have been like, I don't know, entrepreneurs. You want to think like city like leaders and tribal leaders and things like that saying, let's make this bigger. But to me, it was probably somebody that said, listen, I've got all the goods and they're right here and you're going to have to come here to get them. And then it just built from there.
Exactly. You know, we think about economics and cities as being a kind of integrated component. It's, you know, when you have a good economy in a city, it draws people in. And that's certainly not a mystery for ancient time periods as well. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I talk about in the book is about the rise of the middle class, because in a rural village environment, you don't need specialized producers, you don't need specialized educated people to keep accounts, because there's not much to count. And yet when you have more sophisticated enterprises with lots of raw materials coming in and lots of people making objects and then lots of trade going out, you need people to keep track of all that stuff, like who's working and how good is the quality of the raw material and how long is it going to take to make a particular product and who's asking for it, how far away, how are you going to pack it from, you know, being damaged. And so the development of trade and enterprise as a foundational element, you're right, is absolutely there in ancient cities. And it's a year-round thing. You know, this is an observation that V. Gordon Child made back in the 1950s, that when you have a big enough population, then even a person who's making a very specialized object that you only need to buy occasionally has enough customers to be able to set up a year-round shop. So cities become the places where entrepreneurs can manufacture not only regular use things that keep them in business all the time, but they can start to manufacture weird stuff that is only going to get sold occasionally, but there's still going to be somebody to buy it.
Right.
Can we talk a little bit more about the middle class? This fascinated me, this concept of
Well, I mean, now we talk all the time about the decline of the middle class and how the middle class is fading out economically, especially in the United States. But this idea, the middle class came into being as sort of this mediating ground between sort of the lower classes and the upper classes, partly through the development of commerce and this specialized production of items. Can we just talk a little bit more about the middle class as an entity?
Sure. Well, in our village landscape, that was the only type of settlement that people had before about 6,000 years ago, you had everybody doing basically the same kind of work. So people were all farmers. They did a little herding on the side. They did a little gathering on the side. But mostly people were focused on maximizing their production of grain and domestic animals and kind of keeping all of that in their house or sharing it strategically with their neighbors and for community celebrations and things like that. And then you had people who were a little bit above that. They were the village chief or the village shaman or the village healer, the person who had a kind of a skill in organizing people or a skill in healing people. And those were really the only divisions that you had. But when you start to increase populations and you have, for example, a ritual center that people go to on an occasional basis, someone has to be in charge of that. You can't have a bunch of pilgrims coming into a place like Göbekli Tepe or Stonehenge and not being directed and administered in some way. You got to cook over here. You got to eat over here. You got to throw your trash over here. You've got to sleep over here. You've got to go to the toilet over here. Right? So when you have a larger group of people, there has to be some management. And those managers also include people who are entrepreneurs, who are selling things, or who are providing food, or who are organizing the feasting that goes on. And in a ritual environment, you have all of that kind of organization, but it doesn't last very long. You know, like after the feast is done, after the celebration is done, everybody goes home. When people stay in one place long enough for it to become permanent, all of those administrative roles also become permanent. You need someone there all the time to keep track of the trash and the people and the production and the waste. You need someone there to enumerate people. How many people are coming in and out? How many taxes do you have going back and forth from one place to the next? And those people need some education if you're going to be keeping track of people and raw materials, then you need a record keeping system and you need education. And then those people get paid a little bit more because their job is to keep track of others. And that is essentially the birth of the middle class. It's people who are specialized, professionalized, credentialed, educated, and then they have a little bit better salary, which enables them to make decisions about relative kinds of consumption, maybe a little bit better house, maybe some more consumer goods, maybe educating their kids.
Magically, basically, we see the development of this middle class in the kind of certain individuals or households are accumulating additional goods. They maybe have a little bit more space. So there's some subtle signs of increased material wealth, basically, for certain individuals.
Exactly. And that's actually something we can track in the archaeological record. So when we excavate an urban settlement and we go down through those layers of time that represent the buildup of many centuries, we can look and see what kinds of housing there is. We can look and see what kinds of objects people have in their graves. We can look and see the spatial arrangement of housing. Do we have kind of poor quality housing made of broken materials right next to nice structures with stone footings and good quality materials? When we see that, we know that there are people who have a better quality of life, more access to objects than people that they're living with right next door, but that don't have access to the same quality of materials.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we'll take our first break and we'll jump back in the second segment with more questions about cities. Back in a minute.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% 20% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 67. And we are talking to Monica Smith about her book, Cities, the First 6,000 Years. So, Monica, what were some of the more surprising things from your research into cities that you found out?
Well, one of the things that I found particularly interesting is how similar cities are from one place to the next. So, for example, when I work at an archaeological project, I've been fortunate enough to work at some ancient city sites in India and Bangladesh, and also the port of Rome at Ostia. I had a chance to work on a project there. And yet, you know, when you walk around these ancient settlements or other cities that I've visited, like Xi'an or Teotihuacan, they have these remarkable similarities. You'll be walking down a big, broad avenue, and then you'll turn the corner, and you'll be in a little neighborhood of shops and houses. Or you'll walk abruptly to the end of town and you'll see that there's a zone that just kind of trails off and that was kind of the leading edge of an ancient suburb or a road, like a Roman road that goes out into that countryside, or an ancient Chinese road or an ancient Mexican road. And so that really made me think about the ways in which our adaptations for urban life are something that are deeply within our cognitive mechanism to adapt. Because if cities were not the natural habitat of our species, how is it possible that we could have made them at all? How is it possible that we live in them and we are the same species that didn't have cities? Like, where did that come from? That's the thing that I really wonder about the most.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because still thinking about Reno and my recent experience in living in downtown Reno, when we were not living in downtown Reno, my wife and I have been in Nevada for, I think, 12 years now or something like that. And it was only for that 2 years that we actually lived in the city of Reno, within the city limits. And I'll tell you what, when I lived outside the city limits, I'm like, I never want to go there. It's too much hassle. There's too many people. The parking is a pain, even though parking's all free because casinos, but it was still like, I don't want to go down there. So we went to downtown Reno maybe like 5 times in the course of 7 or 8 years. And then all of a sudden we lived there on the 12th floor of a high rise building. And once we lived there and we started talking to other residents and people that lived in downtown, there's only a few residential buildings. The definition of a city for those people that lived there was that Reno's not really a city. And their reason for that was because it doesn't have a lot of services for people who actually live in the city. You've got casinos, you've got restaurants and things like that, but school buses don't come through there. There's no grocery stores except for little markets and things like that. And there's not a lot of the things you find in other, quote, real cities like Manhattan, where you do have all those services within the city. For us to go solidly grocery shopping at a real grocery store, we had to get in the car and drive away from the city to do that. So defining it as a city wasn't defined as a city for people who live there, but people outside of there, especially rural populations in Nevada, think like Elko, Nevada or something like that is going to the big city, but that's another story. But they think Reno, you know, not really is too much of a city for them, but people living in it, not enough city. So I don't know where I'm really going with this, but the definitions of cities and how people perceive them and live in them is all very unique across the planet, I'm sure.
That's interesting too, thinking about Phoenix, which is where I live in, is that giant metro sprawl with incredibly low density.
Yeah.
But I think that what both of you are pointing out that is also worth keeping in mind, archaeologically speaking, is that cities are always in a dynamic process of change. So, you know, one of the reasons that we have to dig at all as archaeologists is that cities had subsequent occupations that buried the earlier habitations under this constant renewal of growth. And, you know, in modern times, when we don't like a building anymore, we can take a bulldozer and just scrape it away. But in ancient times, their mode was mostly like, okay, well, we'll just, you know, pull down the walls and kind of fill in the space and build it up a little bit to get off the, you know, off the floodplain and up off the street. And so cities are growing vertically in ancient times, but cities were also growing horizontally. And we can think about, you know, places like the walls of Rome, that once the walls were built, they were almost kind of obvious because the city of Rome was growing beyond that. And that's the story of every other walled city, too, that you have these places that are growing outside of the formal perimeter because more and more people are getting drawn in. And those folks that you mention in Phoenix or Reno, they can tell you about a time when there was even less services or that there was a certain different kind of feeling, but at least now we have a city target, you know, or at least now we have, you know, a ball team. At least now we have a bigger airport. So these cities are always in the process of expanding. And this kind of dynamic growth is something that is not orchestrated from some, you know, distant governmental entity. It is made by the fact of people moving in, as your experience was. First, you didn't live there, and then you did, and you had a totally different experience of it, and you contributed to that urban life just by being there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before and after when I lived there, my definition of a city was, do they have a Starbucks or not?
You know, that's not a bad barometer for thinking about the scale of population, right? Because, again, this idea of entrepreneurship provides a measure of viability. You know, no Starbucks is going to come in a rural place because there's just not the population base to support it.
Right. Right.
And you've talked about this a little bit in some of your writings, this dialogue back and forth between the sort of management and development of the cities and then the actual use and sort of that organic process of people come and they need and demand things and the city grows. And so the city itself and the people managing the city and developing the city are having to respond in sort of a dialogue. I think is a really interesting concept of how we are talking with each other through cities we live in and the material environment.
Yes, exactly. You know, I think one of the old sociological tropes about cities is that they were these, you know, places of anonymity and, you know, that people were feeling disenfranchised and they were strangers. Really, nothing could be further from the truth, because when you think about urban life, if you're living in a place where you are meeting other people as you walk out the door of your building, as you walk into a store, as you walk down the street, as you are, you know, having transactions at the parking lot, you're talking with new people all the time. And in that densely populated environment, there are more opportunities for people to connect. You connect with people through work. You connect with your favorite barista. You connect with, you know, the people in your building. And so you have these many layers of interaction, which makes cities attractive and actually less lonely than out in the countryside. This is a big challenge in rural populations today, where you have older people who can no longer drive, for example. Once they're in the countryside, it is very difficult for them to connect with other people. And this is true not only in the US, but in other parts of the world, where if there is no public transportation that's viable for rural populations, older people get cut off from medical services, they get cut off from groceries, they get cut off from, you know, engaging with other people. And that's the reason why a lot of older folks are actually moving back into places like Manhattan. They've been out in New Jersey, they raised their kids, and when they retire, they actually move back into the city, because all you have to do is take the elevator down and walk to the corner and you're in a diner. You're meeting other people. You can have food delivered. You can have, you know, medications delivered. And so all of a sudden you're plugged back into human social life because of that urban environment.
Yeah, it's so funny you say that, because that totally played out in the building I lived in. It was a somewhat of a higher end building, and all the owner, we rented there for 2 years. We didn't own because, you know, even though it's Reno, it was still like $300,000 for a 950 square foot apartment. But the people that did own and owned most of the units there and did a lot of the renting were all older, of the older generation. Their kids had moved out. They didn't want to hassle with a house or anything like that. And then, you know, some services and the convenience of having some things that they were interested in nearby, like a diner, and the hospital was just a few streets away. That's one service that is in the city of Reno. It's actually two hospitals within just a few blocks of each other. And so it was all older people that lived there. And then a lot of the renters were, you know, younger people like us and tech entrepreneurs coming in from Silicon Valley, moving over here for Tesla and other things because they could afford it. And they just, they thought city, yay, nightlife, because we do have that being Reno. So we've kind of danced around this a little bit in our course of our conversation so far. But what are some of the biggest similarities between ancient cities and the cities that we live in now?
You know, well, first of all, they're very spatially similar. If you think about the downtowns of ancient cities and modern cities, so whether it's downtown ancient Rome or downtown ancient Tokyo or downtown, you know, Los Angeles, Chicago, or Las Vegas, there's a downtown, and the downtowns usually have a lot of formal planning. So there'll be something like a grid pattern, there'll be some monumental buildings, there'll be some administrative structures like a town hall or, you know, some kind of central administrative office, court building, that kind of thing. And those buildings usually have some kind of administrative purpose, or they're, you know, a concentration of services. So you'll get, you know, a hospital zone that also has a concentration of other kinds of medical services. And then you also have some religious buildings. So even in very secular societies, you will have a church, a mosque, or a temple that's going to be right there downtown as well. And then connecting all those places, you'll have some infrastructure of movement, whether it's roads and streets or a metro or a tram system. You'll have something that connects people together with canals, bridges, streets. And then you've got some places that we often kind of overlook their utility and power, and that is open spaces. So you'll have a plaza, you'll have a town square, you'll have a big open space. And those open spaces are particularly powerful because they can be easily reconfigured. So you can have a fair one day, you can have an LGBTQ rally another day, you can have a demonstration, you can have a marathon, you can have all kinds of things. And those open spaces are often where you get the synergies of change as you get groups of people coming in and making a stand about what they want the city to do. And those places are often the most famous places. Think about Times Square. Times Square is actually a big empty space, but it's surrounded by a whole variety of entertainment options that people are interested in. You know, Trafalgar Square is famous in London. Tahrir Square is famous in Cairo because that's where the Arab Spring was manifested.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because one of the open spaces down in Reno, I keep bringing it back to Reno, but it's where I live for the last like decade and a half. And but we just saw Bernie Sanders speak in one of those big open spaces that things happen just about a week ago. So you're totally right. That's what's happening there. I'm really interested in this because I have a real OCD brain sometimes and I like to look at different things. And I got to tell you, while I don't follow the politics or religious orientation of Salt Lake City in Utah, man, can I appreciate Utah cities, because they came in to the desert and said, you know what? We're building cities and we're doing it from the ground up, and they're all going to be laid out like this. And you can find any address super easy in Utah because it's on a grid and it's predictable, and all the addresses radiate out from the temple, no matter what town you're in. And it's just an amazing place to actually find things. And I appreciate that. And it seems to me like you can really tell an older city based on the lack of a grid plan, because to me, you know, people just came in somewhat haphazardly and it developed into a city, and things just kind of sprung up where they could, when they could. And then as things were destroyed and moved along, maybe they developed a grid like some areas of New York City, Manhattan, places like that. But when in your research did you, if you even found this at all, do you think some of the first planned cities came about, or was that more of a development that was an evolution of existing cities?
So the idea of keeping people organized is certainly something that the first urban planners would have been very interested in doing. It is sometimes quite difficult to know the orientations and plans of the very earliest cities because they were built over so many times that there are many, many layers of occupation between the part of the city that we see today and the earliest habitations, which we can only get through to archaeological excavations. And I think it would be worth pointing out how difficult it is to actually excavate to the bottom of these cities because, you know, the first few seasons of the excavation might be that Olympic-sized swimming pool area, and you can see houses, you can see temples, you can see buildings juxtaposed. But that area of excavation usually diminishes considerably as you go down for lots of logistical and practical reasons. First of all, if you dig down, you know, 5 or 6 feet and you find some really great architecture, you're not going to want to take that out just to see what's underneath. So you end up restricting your excavations to maybe half of that Olympic size pool. And then you find something else, you know, another 5 or 6 feet down. And then you cut your area excavation in half again. So by the time you get down to the beginnings of an ancient city, you're digging in an area that might be half the size of your living room. And obviously you're not uncovering even a single whole building at that point, let alone an entire plan. So it is a little difficult to ascertain whether or not the first cities were planned or unplanned, but your thought about them being relatively organic is probably the more logical thing, that people are coming in and all of a sudden it's only after a generation or two that they realize that they need to get themselves organized. But your comment about the way in which cities can be planned today, I mean, not only places in Utah that you describe and experience, but other cities in the world, authoritarian governments are very fond of planning new capital cities with formal grid patterns. Optimistic nations at the time of independence also tend to plan new capitals with very formalized grid pattern. And we know that ancient rulers also had ideas about making new cities for themselves. So we have a place in Egypt called Amarna that was a new city put in by Akhenaten, the pharaoh who espoused a new religion. We also have in areas of the ancient Near East places where rulers similarly put down brand new cities. And, you know, sometimes those cities thrived and sometimes they barely outlasted the plans of the ruler and became abandoned.
Okay. Well, we are going to abandon the second segment and take a break real quick before we come back, wrap up this conversation with Monica Smith and maybe talk about the future a little bit instead of the past, because archaeologists need to discuss the future in the lens of the past. So we'll be back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 67, and we are wrapping up this discussion with Monica Smith on cities. And one concept, Monica, that comes up a lot these days is gentrification, as especially, again, going back to Reno here, we have this concept, and it's not just Reno, but they seem to be prolific here. There's over 60 mid-century modern hotels. And a lot of people are talking about the saving of these hotels and things like that when a lot of other people want to knock them down and put up other things. But in doing that, you're going to kick out a bunch of populations because there's people living in these hotels. They're the weekly or monthly rentals, and they're lower income individuals because of the nature of the building and the rent price, of course. And they're going to be pushed out into either homelessness because there isn't a lot of other places for them to go, or I don't even know where. You know, gentrification is something that's on everybody's minds. You hear it in major cities and modern cities today. But is this a new concept, or is this something we've been dealing with for 6,000 years?
Along with early urban occupation and along with the idea of a middle class as an aspiring group for greater consumption came the idea of keeping up with the Joneses and doing a little bit better than the Joneses. So yes, that has been part of urbanism from the very, very beginning. And it's, I think, in the Roman world that we can actually see this process of gentrification, because there have been enough excavations in enough places that have gone to enough depth that you can see the changes over time in housing stock. And I have a colleague named Andrew Dufton, who has done a very nice study of Roman gentrification, where you could see that the original layout of the houses in one generation was a number of small houses all in the same block. And then in the next generation, somebody comes through and wipes out half of those little houses to build a mansion. So this sense of reconstruction, rebuilding, repurposing is not new. It's part of that dynamic of city life that we're saying is always happening. There's always a change that's going on that people have opinions about. There are always, unfortunately, class structures in which you have some people who are doing better than others. We know that archaeologically and historically, slums have always been part of urban life and continue to be part of urban life today. And the idea of gentrification is really an interesting one, because there is something about that word, gentrification, that is viewed very negatively. But a lot of the things that go along with gentrification are increasing education of the people who come in. So they have a higher educational level, and they also have a higher economic level, because they are looking to upgrade their circumstances and to fulfill their aspirations of living an urban lifestyle with better amenities and better access to things like education for their children. And I just wonder if, instead of using the word gentrification, which has all of this inbuilt negativity, suppose we called it, you know, economic and educational upgrades.
I like it.
So this is something that's been kind of fascinating me about the book and your other writings, and just the processes of studying these urban environments we live in, is how easy it is to see these processes or social classes that we think of as really modern, but have existed for long periods of time. So thinking about, you know, one of the things that archaeologists are always being asked to do now is, how do we apply our research to modern environments and modern settings? So thinking about your work, I mean, how do you see the application of this, you know, of studying ancient cities to better understanding and adapting and living within modern urban environments?
That's a great question, because of course, you know, all of us who are working with educational institutions, I'm a faculty member at UCLA, I teach a lot of classes, but also engaging with people who are very interested in archaeology. And anybody who's listening to this podcast can try this out about how great it is to be an archaeologist. The next time you're on a plane or a bus, and you know, you strike up a conversation with the person next to you, tell them that, you know, you're interested in archaeology, or you're an archaeologist, or you heard about archaeology, and I guarantee the person sitting next to you will be very excited about that. So people, yes, people love archaeology, and you know, it's a way of us to be able to say, look, the problems that we see in the contemporary world of urban growth, of disenfranchised urban populations, of the challenges related to urban provisioning, all of those things are not new. All of the challenges that we think we are facing, whether it's infrastructure or maintenance or crowding, transportation, none of that is new. All of that has come along with the urban form. So we should take some comfort in the fact that as a species, we have selected urbanism with all of its attendant problems as the best way of solving some of our collective problems. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One of our collective problems is waste and water management, right? We need to have water as a species, and we also need to manage waste. Well, that needs to be done whether you're in a strung out rural place or in a very compact urban environment. But it's much more efficient in an urban environment, because the same length of pipe can service many, many families in an urban household, whereas, you know, a mile of pipe in a rural place might only serve, you know, two or three families. So if we want to think about efficiencies, economies of scale, not just related to production, but to everyday life, urbanism is a very efficient way of drawing that in. Another thing is about the ways in which cities are more open to varieties of lifestyle. And if you think about where LGBTQ movements are, they're in cities. When you think about disability advocacy, that's in cities. When you think about outreach to a whole variety of populations, that's in cities. When you think about cutting-edge medical care, that's in cities, because you have a greater number of people who are interacting, and the desire of humans to interact and to get along and to solve problems, thankfully, is greater than our opposite tendency to fragment. And in cities, you have that physical environment where you're with a bunch of other people and you can get things done.
I think also it's a little more in your face too. You know, I living out in the edges of the city or in the rural areas, you don't see a lot of the homelessness. You don't see a lot of the problems that take place, because all you see is your neighbor, which may be right next to you in a neighborhood, but maybe miles away in some cases. And if they're in trouble, you're more than willing to help them. You know, neighbors help each other and assist each other. But when you're in a city and you're in a high rise, you maybe don't get to see your neighbors that much unless you organize neighborhood things, but you get to see the city a lot, right? And everything that happens inside of that. And maybe you feel that activism bug a little more because it's so much more in your face.
Right. I mean, and the chance to interact with other people is because of that spatial configuration, you know, the idea of, you know, walking down to the diner or going over mm-hmm. to the Starbucks, and, you know, you see people there regularly, and you're more likely to feel empathetic towards them if they have some kind of problem, because they're not just a statistic. They're, you know, they're a real human being right there with you.
Yeah.
And another thing that we can glean from archaeology is that although we can imagine that the human species could have had 7.5 billion people in little villages all over the world, we could still have covered the planet with those little villages and had space left over. But that was not the solution we picked for ourselves. The solution we picked was urbanism, bringing people in. That's why more than half of the world's population lives in cities today. And that proportion mm-hmm. is not going to slow down. There is no such thing as a city that has stopped growing.
Yeah.
So one of the things that has come across very clearly in this conversation is the universality of cities, right? So we see cities around the world. When we go to a new city, we recognize features on the landscape through these common traits. But at the same time, every city you go to also has this really unique personality. And when you travel internationally, you see very different cities, right? You recognize cities and they feel different even as they feel the same. So thinking about looking at past cities, I mean, what can we learn about sort of the beliefs of the people who are living in a city and the culture that they're part of from examining how the cities are laid out and organized and services provided, sort of that actual, the physical infrastructure, right?
Exactly. You know, and that sense of each city having its own flavor or its own brand is also something that Starbucks recognizes, right? Because in any city, Starbucks has a cup that you can buy that has the outline of that city. And, mm-hmm. you know, so there's a sense of participating in that kind of urban branding. Or if you think about, you know, ball teams or sports teams, you know, they all have their own logo, they all have their own sense of belonging. When you're walking around in an unfamiliar city and you see somebody wearing the ball cap of your hometown team, you feel a kind of connection with that person because of those objects that people are wearing. So there is that sense of both universality and the kind of hometown feeling that you can get from your own urban center, or the kind of cachet that some cities have. You know, Paris always has a particular romantic cachet. You know, people think of London in a different kind of way. People think of Chicago in a different kind of way. They think of Mexico City or Tokyo or Johannesburg in a different kind of way, because even though those cities have many of the same amenities and structures, they still have their own sense. And that is also what we can see archaeologically, especially when we have people who have written about their cities. Like, they'll go on a travel log from Rome to Antioch. They'll talk about how their own city is better than the place that they're visiting, or they'll make some wondrous comment about how amazing this city is that they have come to visit. Even the conquistadors said that when they came to the capital of the Aztecs. They were there in a completely unfamiliar place, and they were immediately thinking about, oh, how does it compare to Constantinople?
I think that concept of togetherness, you know, when you see different things like the Starbucks cup or the baseball cap or something like that, you know, and that pride that you have. April and I have talked about before on this podcast. In fact, we did a whole episode on it, the concept of tribalism and nationalism, leading all the way up to nationalism. And I think personally, the development of cities, which and the development of, you know, the keeping up with the Joneses, all that stuff, everything there and all those concepts come down to the basic idea that humans are competitive, and we're competitive in ways that make us develop into these things and say, not necessarily mine is better than yours, but sometimes that's the case. But also in, I want to improve because this is better. So I want to make mine better. Even if that means a city, your family, your building, your product, your thing, whatever the case may be. So looking at possibly that as a foundation for where all this is going, what do cities of the future look like? I mean, if cities have been virtually definable as with the same somewhat narrowly defined parameters for the past 6,000 years, what do the next 6,000 years look like for cities?
Well, I would like to say that humans are both cooperative and competitive. so, you know, I think that that's what enables us to live in these large spaces together, which we wouldn't be able to do if there wasn't at least some cooperative element within that competitive environment. Well, one of the things that is certain about cities is that they are not going away. Mm-hmm. They are certainly going to get bigger, and they are going to continue to be the driving forces for everything, you know, politics, religion, economics. Think about these mega corporations that are involved in the digital world, like Facebook and Google. They could go out to the Midwest and build their facilities where land is cheap and where electricity is cheap, but that's not what they're doing. They are going to the downtowns of places like San Francisco. You know, Amazon wanted to go to New York City. So there is something about cities that will continue to accelerate these processes of production, consumption, and migration. When we think about migration, you know, where do migrants preferentially go all over the world, whether they're coming to the United States or someplace else? They go to cities because that is where it is the easiest to fit in and to find work.
Yeah. You know, I read an article recently about, I think it's in, well, it's in Egypt. They're building a new capital out in the desert outside Cairo, and it doesn't have a name yet. I'm not even sure what stage it's in. I think it's under construction, but they're building this thing from the ground up, and it's going to be a modern city planned with, you know, everything that they want to have in it. I'm not sure how much control they're really putting on this design and the construction of it, or whether or not it'll even get finished, to be honest. But they've got enough oil money over there that they probably will finish it. But do you know anything about that?
Actually, that's news. I will certainly go and look that up. It is exactly, you know, there's a new capital in Nigeria. There's a new capital in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. So this idea of, and of course there's Brasilia, the new capital that was made in Brazil. So these new cities are a wonderful way of thinking about this sort of utopian perception of cities as places where new, positive, cooperative, shall we say, things are going to happen. And by building a new capital, a political group is making a statement. They're making a statement about forward motion expressed in infrastructure and architecture. And that is an amazing thing for a society to even contemplate doing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll leave the article. I don't know if it's the same one I saw, but I left one in our notes here, and I'll leave one in the show notes for the podcast. But if you just type in Egyptian new capital, a number of things come up because apparently other people are talking about it.
I certainly will. And you know, and for your listening audience, if you type in just about any country name and the word new capital, I think you will find some very interesting things.
That's very true. That's very true. All right. Well, we're coming to the end of this, Monica. Thanks for being on. And what's next for you? Do you have more research and publications coming regarding cities as a whole, or are you moving in different directions?
Always. You know, all of the things that I talk about in this book about the middle class, about infrastructure, about consumption, are all things that I'm interested in operationalizing through archaeological research. And along with my colleague R.K. Mohanty, we've been working in India for a number of years. And you know, with archaeology, every answer comes with at least two new questions.
That's right. That's right. Well, we will be more than happy to have you on a future episode to talk about whatever you want to talk about, because this was a great conversation.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate it. And I hope you all have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Yeah, we will. And we will all return to our cities that we live in and think about them just a little bit differently.
That's right. That's right. And recognize that the love-hate relationship of cities is at least 6,000 years old.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.